Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And starting on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, we come to the first headline across the top of the page. Cash short Caraxes inks $25 million deal. This article is written by Frank Van Leeuwen with the Dateline of Durham. And on the far left side of the article that runs horizontally across the top of the page, there's a picture of a man wearing a suit. The caption reads, Patrick Smith developed Alzheimer's candidate, leads Caraxes. Caraxes Pharmaceutical Corporation, formerly Voyager Pharmaceutical, has signed a deal that will provide the Durham company with up to $25 million to finance continued research on its Alzheimer's disease treatment. Caraxes CEO Patrick Smith developed the drug candidate called Memrite, took it into phase 2 clinical trials, and flirted with taking Voyager public before withdrawing the plans in 2005. By 2006, Smith had convinced wealthy investors across the country to pour more than $80 million into the company and develop the Alzheimer's drug. Voyager is now publicly traded Caraxes, having completed a reverse merger in July with Connecticut-based Auto Search Cars. On October 5th, Caraxes filed securities documents outlining plans to raise money to finance Phase 2B clinical trials, an agreement with Southridge Partners, a Connecticut-based institutional investor, allows Southridge to periodically buy Caraxes stock over a 3-year period, starting once the registration becomes effective. Caraxes may need to raise that money sooner rather than later. Caraxes' filing states the company has enough money to continue operations only through December 31. Smith did not return calls seeking comment. Southridge LLC CEO Stephen Hicks also did not return calls seeking comment. The stock offering could jumpstart a clinical program that was halted in 2006 due to Voyager's dearth of financial resources. The company also came under legal scrutiny. Company co-founder Richard Bowen said in 2007 that the U.S. Attorney's Office contacted him as part of an investigation into Voyager. One shareholder, Dr. Robert McGann, said he talked to federal prosecutors about his concerns involving the company's management. He said the company bought Smith's Florida home when he relocated to North Carolina and later sold it at a loss. It's unclear what became of the inquiry. A search of federal court records, turned up no cases involving Voyager. Caraxes has no revenue and reported an $855,000 net loss for the first half of 2010. Going back to the business's founding as Voyager in 2001, Caraxes reports a net loss to date of $88.4 million. The filing states that Caraxes may pursue collaboration or licensing agreements with pharmaceutical companies that could finance further clinical development of Memrite. Linda Pullen, founder of California-based Pullen Consulting, says pharmas are acquiring Alzheimer's drugs because of the huge market potential for an effective treatment. Alzheimer's Disease International, an umbrella group of Alzheimer associations, estimates that the worldwide cost of dementia will be $604 billion in 2010. But Pullen says pharmas are skeptical of drug candidates in light of recent high-profile trial failures of Alzheimer's treatments. In March, Pfizer announced its investigational drug, Dimebon, that's spelled D-I-M-E-B-O-N, failed in phase 3 trials. Raymond Myers, an analyst at Emerging Growth Equities, said in a subsequent research report that he feared the Alzheimer's program, quote, may be irreparably damaged, unquote. Myers owns shares in Medivation, a California company that partnered with Pfizer on Dimebon. Eli Lilly in August halted development of semaglutide, in which in preliminary phase 3 trial results showed that patients using the drug worsened compared to those on a placebo. In Lilly's semaglutide announcement, Jan Lundberg, Lilly's executive vice president for science and technology and president of Lilly Research Laboratories, described the results as a setback but added that the company remains committed to studying Alzheimer's treatments. Those failures makes Caraxes' phase 2B work critical. Pullen says the additional data will be important to any large pharmaceutical company considering taking on the company's drug candidate. Running a good phase 2B can increase the confidence of a potential buyer, she says. And now still on page 1, the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, we go to the middle of the page where there's an article in the center of the page, has a black border around it and a beige background inside. At the top, inside that border, there's the headline in bold black lettering, Vanishing Wealth, Key Industry Sector for North Carolina Shrinking as Billions in Bank of America Wachovia Deposits Flow Out of Charlotte. And this article is written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Raleigh. And the article starts here, but most of the space inside of this border is taken up by a very large building on the lower left side. And the caption says, Wachovia Tower in Charlotte. And then on the lower right-hand section, there's a graph titled, Bye-Bye Bills. While bank deposits have declined severely in the Charlotte market, they are actually up in the triangle. And it shows the, for 2009 and 2010, the bank deposits for the Charlotte area, the triangle, and the triad. Numbers we'll discuss in the article. Billions of dollars and the power to control it are flowing out of North Carolina and specifically out of the city that once prided itself as a center for banking, rivaling global competitors. Total deposits in the vaults of Charlotte Metro Banks plunged by 51% from $184 billion to $89.8 billion in the 12 months ended June 30, according to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. The plunge came as two major stars in the city's corporate constellation, Bank of America and Wachovia Wells Fargo, shifted cash or began accounting for it elsewhere. With the transfers, control of the money also has moved. The control over money goes to where it is accounted for, says independent banking analyst Don Coker. The Queen City banking deposit figures were included in the FDIC's recently released annual market share report for all federally insured banks. According to those numbers, Bank of America slashed its Charlotte Metro coffers by 33% from $77 billion to $51 billion. Meanwhile, its New York office surged by $11 billion. Bank of America spokeswoman Nicole Nastasi says the shift is simply the result of moving money from one location to another. She says much of the decline in deposits in Charlotte was due to a, quote, decline in and reclassification of certain wholesale deposits, unquote, meaning funds the bank obtained on money markets. She notes that Bank of America actually grew its consumer and global wealth management balances in Charlotte during the 12 months. Wachovia, Wells Fargo, with $93 billion in Charlotte in 2009, pared the figure to $24.5 billion by 2010. That's clearly Wells Fargo rebooking some deposits outside Charlotte into its San Francisco office and other markets, says UNC Charlotte finance professor Tony Plath. Also, I think it shows there was a good amount of deposit flight. Add to that a pair of reasons, a third, namely that Wells Fargo is no longer offering the same high-end interest payments that Wachovia offered back in 2008 to attract deposits and preserve capital. All three spell a pretty big drain on deposits, explains Plath. Josh Dunn, corporate communications manager for Wachovia, says, The decrease in Charlotte and North Carolina deposits is due to administrative balance movements from the Wells Fargo-Wachovia merger. After the charters combined in March of 2010, we conformed branch reporting, which included allocating certain deposits to various branches throughout the country. The new FDIC figures show that among the state's major metros, only banking markets in the Triangle and Asheville actually registered any positive growth in the year ending June 30. In the Triangle, deposits grew by 8.2% to $28 billion. In Asheville, they went up by 3.8% to $6.96 billion. The Triad, meanwhile, posted nearly a 17% decline to $26 billion, while Wilmington saw coffers shrink by 4.5% to $5.8 billion. In a year with so much happening in the banking industry, there's probably a lot of noise in some of those FDIC numbers, says William Wagner of the Raleigh office of Howe Barnes, an investment banking firm. Overall, I think you'd have to say that any positive numbers are a net gain for the Triangle. Nitronix adds $3 million to ramp up chip sales. That's the headline on our next story, written by Frank Van Leeuwen with the Dateline of Durham. And this article runs vertically on the front page, along the right side of the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. And underneath the article, there's a picture of a man sitting at his desk in a cubicle, without tie, casually dressed. The caption reads, "Charles Chalvoy says money will help boost sales." 6 months after raising $16.5 million from venture capitalists, semiconductor company Nitronix has added another $3 million to continue expanding its operations to meet growing demand for its chips. Durham-based Nitronix, which has revenue of about $10 million and a little less than 60 employees, noted the additional funding in an amended filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Nitronix's venture capital backers are Alloy Ventures, Arch Ventures, Diamond Head Ventures, and InterSouth Partners. CEO Charles Chalvoy says the additional $3 million comes from a new investor. He says that when he was discussing the Series C round with existing investors earlier this year, a potential new investor expressed interest but needed more time for due diligence. The round closed with the current investors, but Chalvoy offered the new investor the opportunity to invest on the same terms if a decision was made within 6 months. He wouldn't reveal the identity of the new investor but described it in an email as large, U.S.-based, publicly traded semiconductor company that Nitronix is working with on several technology development and manufacturing programs. Chalvoy says the money from the entire round will be used to expand sales and marketing, manufacturing capacity, and to accelerate development of new products for the target markets of military communications, radar, cable television, and next-generation wireless infrastructure. "We're continuing to see strong business activity in all of these markets, with the exception of cable TV, which has been negatively impacted by the slowdown in new housing construction," he says. Chalvoy adds that while the company's business in 2009 and early 2010 was driven primarily by U.S. customers, the company is now seeing more interest in international markets, particularly Asia. Nitronix chips are fabricated with a layer of gallium nitride, a high-performance semiconductor material that is placed on top of a silicon wafer. Don Hutchison, CEO of Silicon Valley-based VLSI Research, says Nitronix is growing into a very specific niche of the semiconductor industry. The chips can be used in military equipment, such as communications gear designed to frequently and randomly change frequencies to make communications more difficult to monitor. "Telecommunications equipment made with a plain silicon chip could not do that," he says. Hutchinson says very few companies work with gallium nitride. Siemens, IBM, and TriQuint Semiconductor, an Oregon company, do some work with gallium nitride chips. Hutchison says LED lighting company Cree makes its chips with silicon carbide because that material produces more light. Nitronix's innovation is its process of making the gallium nitride on silicon chips, which produces a very high yield. Nitronix's technology was spun out of NC State University in 1999. The company's chips became commercially available in 2006. Joan Ito, managing director for manufacturing at Phoenix semiconductor research firm Semico Research Corporation, says businesses are interested in using chips made of high-performance materials as well as those that use less power. In radio frequency devices, it's also important to find a chip that doesn't produce a lot of noise. Some companies use gallium arsenide to achieve higher performance, but that material is more expensive, she says. Gallium nitride is not cheap either, but Ito says it doesn't appear that Nitronix is looking to get its chips into mass production applications, such as mobile devices. Rather, it appears that Nitronix is getting its chips into higher-end applications, such as cellular towers, where companies using the chips realize that they will have to pay a little more for a higher-performance chip. Chalvoy says Nitronix has the ability to drive the cost of the chips down by going bigger, which could make it possible for the company to enter the broader markets, including the wireless space station and military markets. Both Itau and Hutchinson note that Nitronix's higher-performing chips would be of interest to wireless carriers that are upgrading their networks to 4G. Interestingly, the company's board of directors includes Kyle Malady, Vice President of Network and Technology at Verizon Communications. And we have one last article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. This article runs horizontally along the bottom of the page. The headline, Top North Carolina Executives Pulling Down $800,000 Plus, Study Finds. And there's a, first on the far left side of the article, there's a graph going over some of the numbers for the CEO, CFO, and COO based on public or private companies, the averages, and those numbers will be discussed in the article. This article is written by Chris Basden with a Dateline of Raleigh. Even in an uncertain economy, it pays to be the boss. A lot, as a matter of fact. The top executive at a North Carolina company takes home an average of $431,729 and receives a cash bonus of $370,938, according to a new survey conducted by Strategic HR Solutions LLC on behalf of Raleigh law firm Wyrick Robbins. The survey is based on data collected from 109 public and private companies in the state from March through June 2010. The companies represent various industries and range in size from a handful of employees to more than 1,000. Not surprisingly, public company executive salaries at an average of $629,686 significantly outweighed those of their private sector counterparts, which clocked in at $204,493. The mean public company CEO bonus was a whopping $752,347 compared to $76,212 for private firms. This is the second year that Wyrick Robbins has commissioned such a study. Last year, the companies in the study reported an average base salary of $439,486, including $212,531 for private firm CEOs, and $623,618 for public company chiefs. While those numbers make it appear that private company salaries declined significantly in the past year, those behind the survey caution against such conclusions, saying it's an apples-to-oranges comparison. It's probably not that the pay went down, it's just that we had a different grouping of companies that participated each year, says Strategic HR Solutions President Susie Nisbet. Boards of directors often use compensation studies to help determine what their executives will be paid. Raleigh-based aggregates provider Martin Marietta Materials Incorporated, for instance, examines the salaries paid to management at similar size competitors and also takes into account their performance when determining pay for its own execs, says director Richard Vinroot. It's not just throwing a dart against a board, says Vinroot, a Charlotte attorney with the Robinson Bradshaw Law Firm and a former mayor of Charlotte. He says public company boards have to be able to explain their compensation decisions to shareholders, especially if the stock price goes down. Indeed, corporate scandals, including everything from Enron's implosion to the collapse of the housing market bubble, have caused executive compensation to come under increased scrutiny in recent years. Insiders say there's a trend toward incentive-based compensation, such as restricted stock awards that require execs to hold on to a stock for longer periods than in the past. It's an alignment of their financial interest and the company they're working for, says Henry Oman, the director of National Executive Compensation Services for accounting firm Grant Thornton. Another trend at public firms is that the additional disclosure requirements from the government have helped cut down on perks such as country club memberships and golden parachutes. It's a classic situation where sunlight sanitizes, says Michael Jacobs, a finance professor at UNC Chapel Hill's Keenan Flagler Business School. Compensation is more transparent than it used to be. Jacob says that one reason public company salaries may go up, despite the economic uncertainty, is because those other perks have been cut out. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. The headline that starts it off, Tourism Tax Take Up in Wake with August a Record. And under that, there's a picture of the floor of the convention center with quite a few people milling about. The caption reads, Among events attracting visitors was the International Festival at the Raleigh Convention Center. People are coming, people are coming. That's the word from the Greater Raleigh Convention and Visitors Bureau, which tracks tax data as a measure of the health of the tourism business in Wake County. Occupancy tax collections for July and August were up by 15%, or $332,000, over the same 2 months in 2009. Collections in August were the best on record, says GRCVB. As for the other tourism tax, prepared food and beverage, the take was up by 3% over 2009, at $97,000. The Orange County chapter of Habitat for Humanity has begun a 10-month project to build 10 houses for UNC Chapel Hill employees who are now living in substandard housing. The effort to raise money for the project is being led by Patty Thorpe, wife of UNC Chancellor Holden Thorpe. North Carolina State University's much-heralded men's basketball recruiting class will have spiffier rooms to change and train in at the RBC Center this season. The Centennial Authority, which is the landlord for the RBC Center, has spent $19,800 on a renovation that replaced the carpet in the family room and sports medicine area and added HD signal televisions to several rooms, including the locker room. Stripes and logos also were added to the walls. The RBC is a beautiful facility, but after 11 years, there were some upgrades that needed to be made, says Senior Associate Athletics Director David Horning. These improvements were made in the areas where our team and staff spend a great deal of time, so they will be greatly appreciated. The hills are alive. Anyone who saw the 1965 movie The Sound of Music can't forget the song made memorable by Julie Andrews, who played the governess for the seven children of widowed Austrian Navy Captain George von Trapp. While a mischievous lot, it also turns out that the von Trapp kids can sing, and so can their offspring. Sophia, Melanie, Amanda, and Justin are the great-grandchildren of Captain von Trapp, and they're carrying on the family tradition by touring the world and putting on concerts. The troupe will be in Cary on October 23 for a 7:30 p.m. show at the Herbert C. Young Community Center. They'll be accompanied by the Concert Singers of Cary and the Raleigh Symphony Orchestra. Travel magazine has a rose-colored glasses view of farm life, as evidenced by this prose in a recent issue. Whether you want to gather eggs and harvest beans or just retreat from the noise of modern life to a quiet farmhouse porch, these seven stays tap into the romance of rural life. Well, having grown up on a farm, Biz remembers it this way. Up at 5, out to the smelly chicken coop to collect the eggs, then back to shovel out the hen droppings, then throwing down corn for the smelly snorting hogs before shoveling out the pigsty. Hearty breakfast before heading to the fields in fierce heat, no AC, to dig the weeds from around the cotton. You get the picture. Farm life is tough unless you find a way to make it a vacation, which is what the folks at Fickle Creek Farm in Elflin near Chapel Hill are offering. As part of a recent feature titled Secret Farm Hideaways, travel included Fickle Creek. Set on 145 acres of rolling hills just 20 minutes from Chapel Hill, this farm is a showcase of sustainable livestock and produce, says the magazine of the farm that's owned by Ben Bergman and Noah Rannells. Eggs, chicken, beef, lamb, pork, and veggies grown on the farm supply a collection of local restaurants, and the magazine promises that visitors, who can get a room with farm fresh breakfast for $80 a night, won't detect a whiff of anything unpleasant from the dozens of pigs and thousands of chickens a field or two away. How do they do that? Well, up at 5... Biz wants to congratulate Aaron Oakes and Megan Garlapo of NC State University's cycling team. The pair dominated the first Atlantic Coast Cycling Conference cyclocross races of the season, held October 9 and 10 in Richmond, Virginia, taking first place in the men's and women's collegiate A races on Saturday and Sunday. Cyclocross is a type of off-road bicycle racing in which competitors must navigate several types of terrain, such as grass, dirt, sand, or gravel, as well as run over barriers or upstairs while carrying their bicycles. And that's fun? If you find yourself in Hillsboro on the afternoon of Saturday, October 16th, and see giant dancing jumbies, stilt walkers, and people playing music on the streets, don't worry. It's town folks fashioning a parade, literally. The third annual Hillsboro Handmade Parade will begin snaking through the town's downtown district beginning at 2:30 p.m. The parade, put on by the Hillsboro Arts Council, will feature local types parading homemade creations up and down Churton Street. More than 500 participants are expected in this year's parade. The theme of this year's event is Eno River Rhythms, paying tribute to the river that runs through the town. For more details and to find out what a giant dancing jumbie is, check out www.handmadeparade.org. There's a new marquee in downtown Raleigh, and it's not for a restaurant. North State Bank has moved its downtown banking branch to the ground floor of the 230 Fayetteville Street building, which should gladden customers who used to have to go up 12 stories in the 16 West Martin Street building. The new 5,000-square-foot branch will be much more visible to the public, says Larry Barber, president and chief executive of the Raleigh-based bank. Raleigh Mayor Charles Meeker and Downtown Raleigh Alliance President David Diaz helped kick off the bank's reopening on October 13. Triangle Area Home Builders racked up on the awards at the annual North Carolina Home Builders Association's STARS Award event recently in Charlotte. The Wycroft community in Cary, which is being developed by Impact Properties Group, LLC, was awarded the Detached Community of the Year Award. The Portofino community in Clayton, which is being developed by Norwood Thompson and the Waltham Group, was named Master Planned Community of the Year. Other non-marketing related awards went to Brad D. Cummings Construction Company Incorporated of Lillington and to the L&L of Raleigh Incorporated Building Group in Raleigh. It seems like Andy Warhol's 15 minutes just keeps going. The Acklin Art Museum and UNC Chapel Hill has opened an exhibit featuring some of Warhol's Polaroid photos. The exhibit, Big Shots, Andy Warhol Polaroids, features 250 Polaroids and 70 gelatin silver black and white prints that Warhol took between 1970 and 1987. It will be open through January 2. Biz wonders if there are any pics of Campbell's soup cans. It's bad enough to have to accept that humans are descendants of apes, but now we're told that Homo sapiens have a lot in common with a lowly ant. Harvard-trained ecologist Mark W. Moffat, a.k.a. Dr. Bugs, has written a book in which he says that among the animals, only humans and ants deal with issues of public health, highways and traffic rules, market economies, and warfare. Moffat on October 19 will discuss his new book, Adventures Among Ants, at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in downtown Raleigh at 7 p.m. It's a free presentation. Moffat bases his conclusions about ants on 7 years' worth of research in which he traveled around the world to collect stories about their social lives. A contributor of photographs to National Geographic magazine, Moffat also appears regularly on The Colbert Report and Late Night with Conan O'Brien on TV. Eating prime rib at the Angus Barn with the former UNC basketball star to help sick kids. Now that's a good cause that Biz is happy to support. The North Carolina Children's Hospital held its annual Pinwheels and Promises luncheon fundraiser at the Angus Barn on October 12. Spotted among the 300 attendees who crowded into the Raleigh restaurant's outdoor pavilion were former Tar Heel hoop standout Eric Montrose, local television celebrity Sharon Delaney McLeod, lawyer Woody Webb, and Howard Merrill and partner CEO Jim Cobb. The Children's Hospital, which has about 150 beds, treats children with either complex or chronic illnesses including cancer, cystic fibrosis, and rare genetic diseases. It has about 10,000 inpatient visits every year and many more outpatient visits. Our goal is to see that we can deliver any care a child needs so they don't have to leave North Carolina to get that care, says Dr. Alan Stiles, the physician in chief for the hospital. Science Magazine's latest issue includes a list of the top biotech and pharma companies to work for, and several companies with major triangle operations made the grade. At number 7, Syngenta ranked highest of those companies, Merck was number 9, Novartis was number 11, and Biogen IDEC number 15. Alas, GlaxoSmithKline was nowhere to be found. The top employer on Science's list was San Francisco-based Genentech. Science says the ranking was determined through a global web-based survey that asked respondents to name the companies considered best, average, and worst. For a glimpse into the latest in agricultural biotechnology, check out the NC Biotechnology Center on October 22. The Biotech Center, in partnership with Nagoya University and NC State University, is holding the NU Tech Ag Biotechnology Industry Roundtable. Contributing to Biz were staffers Chris Basden, Cameron Snipes, Amanda Jones-Hoyle, Frank Van Leeuwen, and James Gallagher. And now we return to the full-length articles inside the Triangle Business Journal. The first article we come to, South Carolina firm looks for lawyers may open here. And this article is written by Chris Basden with a dateline of Raleigh. The McNair Law Firm, a prominent South Carolina shop, is sniffing around the Triangle for attorneys, a search that, if successful, could add a new competitor to the area's legal marketplace. While the search has been conducted quietly so far, Bailey and Dixon attorney Michael Wiesel is one of several local legal insiders who have caught wind of it. There are indications that the McNair Law Firm is looking to expand its presence into Raleigh, Wiesel says. McNair managing shareholder David Teagues could not be reached for comment. Columbia-based McNair, which was founded by former South Carolina Governor Robert McNair, has about 130 lawyers and 9 offices in several cities, including Charleston, Myrtle Beach, Hilton Head, and Greenville. Currently, the firm's only office outside South Carolina is in Charlotte. If McNair does establish an office in the Triangle, it would be a second coming of sorts. In 1993, McNair and former North Carolina Governor Terry Sanford joined forces to form a bi-state law firm called McNair Sanford. Sanford split away from the firm just 2 years later, saying he was uneasy in a big firm. Sanford died in 1998. McNair died in 2007. Based on the number of attorneys it has in various practice areas, the McNair Law Firm does a lot of corporate, real estate, and litigation work. Lobbyist disclosure forms filed by attorneys and professional consultants at McNair show that the firm has done work for the likes of Bridgestone Americans Holdings Incorporated, Eli Lilly and Company, International Paper Company, Publix Supermarkets Incorporated, U.S. Bank, American International Group Incorporated, and Diageo North America. Firms open offices in new cities based on a couple of motivations. The main reason is because they have clients in the area, says Vera Wright, who runs Raleigh-based Legal Placement Specialists Incorporated. Law firms also will open an office in an entrepreneurial bid to attract new clients, she adds. Wright is not involved in McNair's search. Nelson Mullins and Nexen Pruitt are other prominent South Carolina firms with outposts in the Triangle. Nexen Pruitt established a beachhead in the area a couple of years ago by hiring Tom Johnson away from Warden Smith. The Triangle office has gradually grown to 8 attorneys. Johnson says the best way to enter a market is to merge with an existing firm or pick off a practice group from an existing firm. It's good to be working with someone who knows the business and legal community in Raleigh, Johnson says. It may not be the best time to go poaching, whether for individual attorneys or an entire practice group, due to the economy. In our next article, for this we move down the page to the center of the page. There's an article with a black border around it. Inside that border at the top, there's a picture of the outside of the Employment Security Commission building. And within that picture, there's a graph that's titled, Where's the Growth? Raleigh performs fairly well when it comes to income dollars, but fails miserably in terms of income growth. And it goes on to list the top 5 and the bottom 5 cities in terms of growth, cities we'll discuss in the article. The caption under the picture, the ESC is just one place that displaced workers are going to find new work. And then under that, there's the headline in the article. The headline, huh? Raleigh at number 98? Per capita income growth lags here, says study. And this article is written by Lee Weisbecker with a dateline of Raleigh. High flyers have a greater distance to fall. That old notion comes into sharp focus with the release of a new study that examines which of the nation's top 100 metros generated the most per capita income growth over the quarter century between 1984 and 2009. In what surely will be a surprise to many hereabouts, the Raleigh Metro finished only two places out of dead last in 98th position out of 100. That was with a 2009 per capita income of $37,849 and a 25-year income growth rate of 167%. Charlotte didn't do much better, finishing 96th, while Greensboro was 94th. The results are from a study conducted by American City Business Journals for its 40 U.S. business weeklies, including Triangle Business Journal, and for Portfolio.com, an ACBJ holding. El Paso, Texas, with a 25-year per capita income growth rate of 212%, was the top metro in the U.S., leading developers of the study to surmise that perhaps government and economic development officials should be aware of the fact that it's the smaller communities that are flourishing. Per capita income is the calculation of all income coming into an area divided by the number of people there. The ACBJPortfolio.com results fly in the face of every common assumption held about Raleigh and the Triangle, namely that the region, with its diverse economic base of public institutions and a cross-section of private employers, has developed a dynamic economy engine that resisted succumbing to the current downturn and will lead the state in the recovery. What happened? What happened is that in Raleigh and the Triangle, starting in late 2008 and through 2009, the final comparison year of the ACBJPortfolio.com study, a broad-based downturn cut into the middle class more deeply than in prior recessions. As the jobs of such workers disappeared, so too did their bigger paychecks. As David Clegg, Deputy Director of the Employment Security Commission of North Carolina, has stated repeatedly over the past year, this has been a middle-class recession. Just ask Lon Goldman, who for almost 7 years ran the sales division of a large publicly traded company with an operation in the Triangle. He declines to name the firm, but when his job recently ended, so too went his six-figure income. Undeterred, he's looking for a new opportunity. And whether it is something that I do on my own or a new job I take, I know I will be a success, says Goldman, who for now is working as a consultant. Between 2008 and 2009, per capita income slumped by an average of 2% across North Carolina. In the Raleigh metro, it declined by 4%, according to federal income data. Not only was the region losing higher-paying jobs, it also was continuing to welcome new residents. And this population growth would certainly affect the calculation of the region's per capita income figure, says John Quinterno, an employment expert with Chapel Hill-based South by North Strategies. Responding to the methodology of the ACBJPortfolio.com study, Quinterno questions whether it really makes a whole lot of sense to chart the region's income story over as long as two decades. The Triangle, with Raleigh as its population centerpiece, is too much a modern creation to chart over any great expanse of time. Behind the study's top finisher of El Paso, Texas, with a population of 751,296, came Baton Rouge, population 786,947, 25-year income growth 201%, Baltimore, 2.96 million, 216%, Virginia Beach, Norfolk, 1.67 million, 192%, and New Orleans, 1.18 million, 201%. The last three hardly qualify as smaller communities. A statistical index was calculated explaining why total percentage growth is not in precise descending order. The Raleigh area population number used in the study was 1,125,827. As to the notion that an area's income history is a predictor of future growth, Carl W. Smith of UNC School of Government says an array of factors determine which communities grow. It's a list that begins with educational opportunities and transportation, he says. Generally, it's been found that it's the larger and medium-sized communities that have the strongest growth, he says. That has certainly been the pattern in North Carolina, he says, where Charlotte and the Triangle have been the strongest growth magnets. It's just easier to do big business in a bigger area where companies find it easier to find the qualified workers they need, Smith says. Major decline for state stake. This article is written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Raleigh. Even though the market value of a $35.3 million North Carolina pension system investment in Mark Stone Capital Partners fell to $30 million in the first 4 years of the deal, the cash remains parked with the private equity investor now mired in controversy. Mark Stone is an Israeli-based private equity fund that agreed to hand over $18 million to settle a so-called pay-to-play scandal in New York and that now faces a revolt from investors who contend they can't get performance data. The North Carolina pension system, under then-Treasurer Richard Moore, committed to invest a total of $50 million in the fund, which invests primarily in old economy Israeli businesses. As of June 30, 2009, the state had transferred $35.3 million to the group, plus at least $4 million in management fees. Meanwhile, the market value of the investment, what the state would get if it cashed out, had declined from $32 million in June 2008 to $30 million 12 months later. They are the latest figures available. The state says its annual return from Mark Stone for fiscal 2009 was negative 16.5%, while the three-year return was 8%. Mark Stone marks the third private equity or real estate investment made by Moore, who was treasurer, from 2001 to 2009 to come to some sort of grief. The others are as follows. A $400 million exposure to an overseas Morgan Stanley real estate fund that essentially collapsed in April. A $300 million stake in London-based Terra Firma, which saw its investment in UK-based EMI Group lose two-thirds of its value in early 2010. Pension officials have given no full accounting of the outcome of other deals. An attempt to reach Moore for comment at the Raleigh Office of Relational Investors, where he now works, was not successful. Large pension fund investments can take years to pay off because it takes time to deploy the capital and then more time for the firms receiving it to act on the business plans, says Chapel Hill investment advisor Charles Leedy. Heather Strickland, spokeswoman for current treasurer Janet Cowell, Moore's successor, confirmed the pension system's continued stake in Mark Stone, but she declined to comment on recent developments surrounding the group or whether the state would review its relationship. All private equity fund relationships are monitored on a regular basis, she said. Mark Stone was founded in 2003 by California venture capitalist Elliot Broidy, who pleaded guilty in December to shelling out more than $1 million for illegal gifts, including campaign contributions, travel expenses, and consulting fees to win a $250 million investment from the New York pension system. The pension official who allegedly took the bribe pleaded guilty the week of October 7. Private equity falls within what the pension system classifies as an alternative investment. Despite the difficulties coming from some of its past commitments, the North Carolina system still had 5% of its total assets in the class as of June 30. That's not unusual, says Leo Kalavakis, who researches public pension systems and produces Pension Pulse, a blog on the subject. European managers have been cooling in recent months on alternatives in general and private equity in particular. But not so much in the U.S., Kolovakis says. In our next article, which runs horizontally along the bottom of page 3, was written by the TBJ staff with a Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, After 19 Years, Grunwald Retiring as TBJ Publisher. Charlene Grunwald, who has served as publisher of Triangle Business Journal since its acquisition by American City Business Journals in 1991, will retire at the end of the year. Grunwald began her career with ACBJ, publisher of 40 weekly business journals in markets across the nation, in 1986 in the circulation department of the Charlotte Business Journal. Within 3 years, she had risen to fill two management positions simultaneously, circulation director and business manager. ACBJ closed on the acquisition of Triangle Business Journal, then known as Triangle Business, on October 31, 1991, and Grunwald was named publisher. The journal since has charted consistent growth. Throughout her tenure as publisher, Char has worked tirelessly to make Triangle Business Journal a respected voice in the Raleigh-Durham-Chapel Hill community. ACBJ CEO Whitney Shaw said upon announcing Grunwald's retirement, "Clearly, she has succeeded on every count." Under Grunwald's leadership, Triangle Business Journal has won numerous national, regional, and state journalism awards for its business news coverage. In recent years, ACBJ consistently cited Triangle Business Journal as one of the fastest-growing papers in the group in paid circulation growth. The Triangle market has proved to be one of ACBJ's stronger markets, and that's a tribute to the dynamic business community in which it's been my pleasure to live and work for the past 15 years, says Grunwald. Grunwald says she intends to stay busy by traveling, playing golf on the coast where she owns a home, and visiting family in her native Wisconsin and in other locales. A search is underway for her successor, Shaw says. Unlike some, North Carolina says it's ready to set up exchange. This article is written by James Gallagher with the Dateline of Raleigh. North Carolina officials say they believe the state has the staff and expertise to develop a health benefits exchange system to comply with the Federal Health Care Reform Act, even as other states are concerned whether they can. States are working to develop exchanges in accordance with the Federal Affordable Care Act, and some states have expressed doubts about whether they have the staff and knowledge to do so, according to a recently released report from the Kaiser Family Foundation. The report adds that with so many states working at the same time, it could be difficult to find employees and expert consultants to work on the projects. "There are only a few people in the world who have set up an exchange," says Robin Rudowitz, a Kaiser policy analyst. But North Carolina officials say they are confident they have, or soon will have, the resources needed to meet the challenges of developing an exchange. Louis Bellow, Chief Deputy Commissioner of the North Carolina Department of Insurance, says he believes that the state is in a good position, noting the recent receipt of a $1 million grant from the federal government to fund the work needed to create an exchange. Health benefit exchanges are systems to provide individuals and small groups with health care, either through Medicaid or through private insurers. The systems are intended to have the capability to determine whether a person is eligible for Medicaid, and if not, whether they are eligible for any government subsidies for private health insurance. While health care reform won't be fully implemented until 2014, the exchanges have to be ready to go in early 2013 so that individuals shopping for insurance can have coverage beginning January 1, 2014. At this point, North Carolina is in early discussions about whether and how it wants to develop its exchange. The state has created an advisory board consisting of legislators, state officials, public health officials, doctors, insurers, and academics to study the various options and to provide guidance to the General Assembly, which ultimately would set up an exchange through legislation. The board is reviewing whether the state should develop its own exchange, partner with other states, or leave it to the federal government. Few seem in favor of the latter. Also to be decided is whether an exchange should be run by a state agency or by a state-affiliated nonprofit, whether there should be separate exchanges for individuals and for groups, and several other issues. Pam Silberman, president of the North Carolina Institute of Medicine, which is working closely with North Carolina DOI, Department of Insurance, and the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services on developing an exchange, says the early work is largely focused on policy decisions. "That work has to be done quickly," says Lanier Cancellor, DHHS Secretary. "The creation of the actual computer systems that will run the exchange is not going to be a quick or easy task. I think it can be done," he says, "but we can't waste a lot of time." North Carolina had a bit of a head start in working toward the exchange system because the state had begun efforts to modernize its Medicaid enrollment system by incorporating enrollment and management of all Medicaid and other DHHS services into one statewide system to better manage and track social programs. Hospital support groups feel economic pinch. Foundations backing UNC hospitals, Rex and Wake Med, see signs of revival in giving. This article is written by James Gallagher with a Dateline of Raleigh. Area hospitals have struggled to bring in donations in recent years, though there are signs that the drought may be easing. At the Medical Foundation of North Carolina, the fundraising arm of UNC Hospitals, donations declined from a record high of $110.8 million in fiscal year 2008 to $83.2 million during the most recent fiscal year, which ended June 30, 2010. But foundation leaders say that year-to-date donations are up by 50% compared to last year. Executive Director David Anderson attributes the surge to people feeling more comfortable with the state of the economy. He says the foundation recently received a $1 million gift from a donor who had planned to make the contribution a couple of years ago, but had put that off due to the economy. The Medical Foundation uses its funds primarily to provide student scholarships, support professorships, fund research, and pay for some patient care. Capital projects are funded through hospital operations or state appropriations. Jack Radford, executive director of the Wake Med Foundation, which supports Wake Med Health and Hospitals, says fundraising for its fiscal year 2010, which ended September 30, had nearly reached fiscal 2009 levels by the end of June. The organization reports it received $2.8 million in cash and pledges through the first 9 months of fiscal 2010, compared to $2.81 million through all of 2009. Year-end totals for 2010 are projected to exceed $3 million. In 2008, however, the organization took in nearly $4.5 million, according to figures provided by Radford, though he says 2008's tally was skewed by two large donations of $1.5 million and $1 million, respectively. Total dollars received in 2009, however, were down substantially from 2008, according to the Foundation's federal 990 tax form. In 2008, the organization took in nearly $8.2 million compared to just $5.3 million in 2009. Those totals include dollars pledged in previous years but not paid until 2008 or 2009. While most organizations use the numbers reported to the IRS as an official fundraising figure, Radford says the 990 is not a good barometer of how the fundraising activities are actually doing, because it includes dollars pledged in prior years. The Rex Foundation, which supports Rex Healthcare, has not yet seen its fundraising tick back up, but the organization is working to boost donations into the range of $5.5 million annually. The foundation took in $2.4 million in fiscal year 2009, but saw its haul fall by 25% to $1.8 million in fiscal year 2010. Rex Hospital spokeswoman Lisa Schiller says fundraising had not been a major focus for the hospital in the past, but with plans for a $60 million cancer hospital, as well as a $130 million expansion, the hospital is adjusting its focus. "We're definitely going to need the community support for that," she says. "Fundraising absolutely will become an important part moving forward. Philanthropy is going to be incredibly important to us." Still, it could be several years before hospitals and their foundations are able to grow giving beyond 2008 levels. The Association for Healthcare Philanthropy reports that hospitals and their affiliated foundations saw donations fall by 11% from 2008 to 2009. An association president, Bill McGinley, says he's glad giving didn't fall further. "It could have been a lot more," he says. The last major drop in donations to healthcare providers occurred in 2002, and then it took more than 4 years to return to 2001 levels. And now for our remaining minutes, we turn to the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. GE Aviation touts 40 new Durham jobs. GE Aviation announced that it has so far invested more than $8 million in plant improvements and equipment at its jet engine assembly plant in Durham in 2010, leading to the creation of 40 new jobs this year and additional job creation plans for 2011. GE Aviation spokeswoman Deborah Case says Durham plant managers have not determined how many jobs will be created next year. The total is not expected to reach 40 again, but the number will be in the double digits. Fired up business sector boosts Republicans. If Republicans win control of the House, they will owe a debt of gratitude to an energized business community. Business owners are more engaged in this election than in any in recent memory, says the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the National Federation of Independent Business. That's because they're scared about the policies coming out of the Democratic-controlled Congress and President Barack Obama's administration, according to these business organizations. Durham apartments sold for $29.5 million. Prudential Real Estate Investors of Atlanta has paid $29.5 million for a 287-unit apartment complex near Research Triangle Park. Prudential bought the Southern Oaks at Davis Park apartment complex from Wood Partners of Charlotte, which developed the property in 2007. The price that Prudential paid averages $102,787 a unit. Raleigh man gets prison time for fraud. A federal judge has sentenced Scott Waddell of Raleigh to 51 months in prison and ordered him to pay $1.7 million to victims of a fraud scheme he allegedly operated for 5 years. The U.S. District Attorney for the Eastern District of North Carolina, George E.B. Holding, announced. Waddell, 51, pleaded guilty to wire fraud in January, but U.S. District Judge James C. Deaver did not sentence him until October 6. Between 2003 and 2008, the U.S. District Attorney's Office said Waddell ran a fraudulent copier leasing scheme. BioCryst Pharmaceuticals moving to Durham. Drug development firm BioCryst Pharmaceuticals is shifting its corporate headquarters to Durham from Birmingham, Alabama, and bringing with it about 15 job positions to the Triangle. BioCryst CEO John Stonehouse says the company's laboratory and drug discovery researchers will remain in Birmingham, where the company has been based since it was founded in 1986. Currently, 30 BioCryst employees work from the Imperial Center Business Park office, Durham, including Stonehouse. BioCryst will be moving the rest of its administration, clinical, and regulatory operations to Durham to take advantage of more efficiencies. Durham also is where the company's commercial marketing staff will be based once BioCryst's first drug offering goes to market. BioCryst has received approvals this year in Japan and Korea for its flu treatment drug Paramivir. That's spelled P-E-R-A-M-I-V-I-R. Glenwood South gets new gym. A new fitness facility called HEAT, an acronym for Highly Effective Athletic Training, is opening this week at the Creamery building in the Glenwood South District of downtown Raleigh. HEAT owner Robin Fitzgerald has leased the 4,172-square-foot space formerly occupied by Edge Office Space at 400 Glenwood Avenue, and the center will celebrate its opening October 15. HEAT is a non-membership-based training studio that provides variety of one-hour workout classes that combine cardio interval training with strength conditioning, including real rider bikes that simulate real road experiences. And we'll quickly just read the beginning of this article, headlined, A Moving Way to Pay the Bills, Nonprofit Puts Those It Helps to Work and Generates $3.7 million in Revenue, written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Durham. When Kevin McDonald devised a plan to start the Trosa Residential and Commercial Moving Company in Durham 15 years ago, his purpose was twofold. He needed a real-world way to practice the lessons in communication, leadership, and work ethic that residents of the Trosa Substance Abuse Recovery Program were being taught, and that has now grown into a fleet of 150 cars, trucks, and tractor-trailer trucks. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.